Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is New Books in Film. I'm Annie Burke, and today I'm sitting down with A.S. Hamra, film critic at The Baffler, former film critic at N+1, and regular contributor to outlets including Book Forum, Harper's, and others, and author of the 2018 collection, The Earth Dies Streaming, Film Writing 2002 to 2018 from N+1 Books. I'm thrilled to be sitting down with Scott today, as I hope we can pick up on some of the threads and themes I discussed with my guest from last month, historian of film criticism, Daniel Fairfax. And with me, I'm so glad to sit down with really one of the most prolific and engaging practitioners of criticism working right now. By his own testament, this is a quote, my guest does not luxuriate in mediocrity. So I've done my homework and everyone should prepare themselves for a conversation just above average. Thank you for joining me, Scott.
Thank you for having me on.
Of course. Okay, I'm going to get right into it. What's the matter? What's gone wrong with film criticism today?
Well, most film criticism that's written today is a form of publicity for movies that's completely dependent on film release schedules and access. Criticism has merged with entertainment journalism more than ever. It's not really an independent entity in most places. And there are more people that want to be film critics than there are jobs. So there's a vast, army of underpaid people or people that now work as amateurs and write for free for places like Letterboxd, which is a social media site that, people can write short reviews of films on. And what really has led to the decline in film criticism, besides the capsule review form that started really picked up the most in the 1980s, I think, is Rotten Tomatoes, which aggregates film criticism and assigns a very loose score to films, a percentage score based on how many good or bad reviews a film has gotten. And then marks films as fresh or rotten, a kind of thumbs up, thumbs down approach for the 21st century. And that site is owned by two studios, Warner Brothers and Universal. So, it's collating criticism in the service of the studios, not readers or cinephiles or film fans or movie buffs or however you want to characterize people that go to the movies.
You make an interesting point in your discussion of Rotten Tomatoes, which is that sometimes it's misleading, even the formula that what they decide is a fresh or a rotten review. And reading your criticism, I don't think an algorithm is up to the challenge of figuring out whether you, what you thought of movies, because sometimes your assessment is sort of so oblique and dry that I have a really hard time believing that your work could fit the Rotten Tomatoes algorithm. I think that must be on purpose.
I mean, I write specifically so that Rotten Tomatoes can't tell whether I like or dislike the film. But I mean, I'm on Rotten Tomatoes. You know, critics oftentimes don't ask to be part of that. People that ask to be part of it, I wonder about them. But they just, at Rotten Tomatoes, find you and put you up, put your name up there, and put the name of the magazines or whatever that your newspapers that you write for. And then they start collating reviews and assigning them these scores. And, you know, an actual person does that. Someone reads your reviews and then decides whether they're fresh or rotten. And in my experience, approximately 20%, maybe 25% of what I write is mischaracterized by the person doing that. And I've noticed for other reviews that I read there, you know, I try not to read film reviews before I've written my own, if it's something I'm going to be writing about. Mm-hmm. But sometimes afterward, I'll look to see how a film did. And I'll read reviews and they'll be given scores of fresh or rotten. And you can tell that it's the opposite. So there's not a lot of, I don't have a lot of faith in their scores, but the scores have become a form of publicity. You know, movies, you know, studios want to be able to put that sunburst on the poster or other kinds of advertising that says 100% fresh. And if you look at Rotten Tomatoes, you know, they try to collate film reviews from past decades as well. You'll see that, you know, 20 years ago, films did not, there were far fewer films that had scores of 100% or scores in the high 90s. There was a far greater, range of thought and opinion on any individual film than there is now. Somehow Rotten Tomatoes has created a herd mentality that they've focused, you know, and I'm not sure why that is exactly. Except for now, people are afraid to actually criticize things. And we live in a world of likers.
Well, very glad that I'm not interviewing a liker right now.
I mean, but, I like lots of...
Yeah. Not I know you do. I'm sure you do, Scott.
I'm not trying to be negative. Whenever, every film I see, I want it to be good, you know?
Of course, yeah. We all want it to be good. But I just want to pick up on one more thing you said before I ask you a little bit about how you became a professional... not liker necessarily, a professional critic, I just want to draw out sort of the things that we're saying that have gone wrong with criticism is kind of a corporate or studio sort of control over criticism turning into a kind of extension of their PR departments, and also the contingency and the inability for critics to make a living. It seems like together you can look at something like Netflix's Tudum, which seems to combine both of those, right? You have like the studios taking over their own criticism branches, but without, there's not even the kind of professional security that would come with that. You get that other piece of it too, which is that everyone got fired basically.
Yeah, wasn't it Tudum?
Oh, was it?
Tudum was the name of that.
Tudum, like ta-da?
Like ta-da.
Latin? Yeah, ta-da. Oh God, Latin ta-da, okay.
I don't think they wanted it to be called too dumb.
You know. Like tedium. I don't know.
They had a problem naming things at Netflix. You may recall they tried to separate off their DVD mail order segment or whatever division. And they called it Quickster and everybody got mad at them.
Quickster? Okay. Yeah, no, I totally forget that. Yeah, I do remember when I could order DVDs to my home though, because I remember when Netflix did that.
When they decided they were more of a streaming service than a mail order DVD rental outlet, they split off the division that does the DVD mail order and they changed the name to Quickster.
That's terrible.
Quickaster, I think it was. And they, Netflix subscribers were very annoyed by how dumb that was. And they quickly changed it back a week or so later. But they have a problem with names at Netflix.
Well, I wonder if it's being run by a bunch of elder millennials like myself, because Quickster sounds like Napster to me, and I wouldn't really want to have any connection to Napster, just associated with the slow dial-up. And
I mean, it's hard to know But it's hard to know what process led to the creation of the name Quickster.
Impossible.
Or the creation.
Black box.
Yes. Or the creation of the name Ta-dum.
Ta-dum.
Neither of those things exist anymore, although I think they are still publishing content on Ta-dum.
Oh, really?
You know, I don't know. Everybody got laid off and then they, you know, they moaned and gnashed their teeth and rent their garments about it. Mm. I mean, that I have no sympathy for anyone that quit a job to go to work for Netflix. I mean, it was obvious that they were just going to be doing PR, branded content at best.
Well, I have sympathy, but I came to my love of film and film writing in a slightly different way. That's my very slick way of segueing into another question, Scott, which is, how did you come to writing for film and arts criticism? My sense is that you did not work writing press releases for Netflix. That doesn't sound like that was your start. What was it?
Well, Netflix didn't exist when
it did not.
Film criticism.
No, you're right.
I really want to emphasize, Annie, how little mm-hmm. sympathy I have for people who work for Ta-dum.
I have sympathy, which is why I was changing the subject. But yes, you have the floor, Scott.
They were completely rooked. I mean, it was a con job. And mm-hmm. and I hope that they learned something about the nature of American corporate capitalism from that. You know?
They're unemployed, many of them. So I think they did learn.
Yeah, I you know, judging by what I've seen on Twitter, I'm not so sure about that.
Oh, they got jobs? Well, that's good.
No, I don't mean they got jobs. I mean, they didn't learn.
Oh.
So I just think that was, you know, I'm surprised there's not more writing about that. I know there was some, you know, there was some collapse of Ta-dum pieces, a couple. But, you know, that's another one of these things that, you know, business journalism around entertainment is not very thorough, and it's also been largely co-opted by publicity, you know. So the goings on at Netflix are now becoming more well known as it starts to fail, you know, and scramble, which mm-hmm. it's doing, you know, and the collapse of Ta-dum was part of that. And you know, I would love to read more, you know, business writing about that kind of stuff.
Note that a lot of journalists can't make a living doing what they're doing. So maybe that's why you're not seeing that kind of reporting.
Maybe they would need
to go work for a place that is like Ta-dum and then they get fired. That could be a problem.
I don't think Netflix's Ta-dum was going to do any actual business reporting.
Unlikely. But just a general bigger picture journalism problem is nobody's making enough money.
Well, journalism is in a lot of trouble, that's for sure. But, you know, the last piece I read about Netflix, for instance, was in the Hollywood Reporter, and it was about Ted Sarandos receiving the Person of the Year award at the Cannes Lion Festival.
And
that award was presented to him by Kara Swisher, who is a New York Times tech columnist.
Oh.
And at the same time, the next morning, they laid off 300 more people at Netflix. Their stock crumbled another 70%. So I don't know how Ted Sarandos is the Person of the Year, you know?
I agree with you on that.
You know, he's going to Cannes Lions so he can start getting advertisers to pay money to advertise on the new lower tiered ad supported level of Netflix subscription. I mean, Netflix is, you know, started out as a company that sent people movies through the mail. It was very cinema focused.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's becoming, a television broadcast network in an age when the television broadcast networks are completely obsolete. So how this adds up to Person of the Year, I really would like to know. But getting back to how I started in film criticism, I guess, mm-hmm. rant about Netflix all day. But I started writing for zines in the 1990s, and I was the co-editor of a zine that was published in the 90s in Boston, Massachusetts. And, you know, I was trying to write, you know, professionally as well. And I was a projectionist in a movie theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which was the Brattle Theater, one of the great movie theaters in the country that's been showing movies continuously before the pandemic since the late 40s or early 1950s. And that's how I started. I was writing, you know, in what were essentially underground publications.
Something else you mentioned in your book is that you grew up in the sphere of Jeanine Basinger at Wesleyan and the kinds of programming that are happening in that part of Connecticut. And I thought that might be of interest to some of our listeners, because so many people listening right now are in the academy in some form and might know who Jeanine Basinger is. But it seems to me that she shaped sort of your coming of age and the kinds of movies you grew up treating as like the films of your youth, so to speak.
That is true. I grew up in a very, very small town in Connecticut, and it was kind of a rural town, and there were only about 3,000 or 4,000 people in the town when I was growing up there. And it was right next to Middletown, which is where Wesleyan University is. Mm-hmm. And there was no movie theater in my town or the two towns next to it. So in order to see movies, you know, we had to go to Hartford or New Haven. There was a second run movie theater in Middletown, and there was a drive-in that was open in the summer, but there was really no first run movie theater. So I was very interested in seeing movies, and Wesleyan University showed all the films that they showed for film classes also to the public, because they did two shows of their movies, and they showed them in movie theaters that they had on campus. And for a few dollars, members of the public could go in and see these films too. It was kind of like a film archive situation, like the Harvard Film Archive or the Pacific Film Archive in Berkeley. But it wasn't quite as grand as those. And they, you know, she was the head of the film department there, Jeanine Basinger or Basinger. And I saw a lot of films by, you know, classic Hollywood films, and by Ernst Lubitsch and Raoul Walsh and Howard Hawks and John Ford. And I saw a lot of foreign films by, you know, Bergman and Godard and all sorts of things, you know, two or three times a week once I got my driver's license. And I saw a lot of those things before I ever saw, Raiders of the Lost Ark or something like that. So, I was seeing those things during the blockbuster era. This was the early 1980s, mid-1980s, I guess. And, it was great. It was a great education in the cinema, and it kind of inoculated me against crap, I guess, lack of a better word. It was really fantastic that they offered that to the public. I don't know if they do that anymore, because they probably don't project movies on film anymore.
Probably not. Do you think that being a projectionist shaped any of your sort of interests as a film writer, or is that just sort of another piece of your journey in loving movies?
I got that job because I needed a job, but I was already writing. I was already writing.
Oh, excuse me. Okay. Yeah.
But just for zines, you know. But earlier, while I was college aged, I had worked in movie theaters. I worked in a movie theater in Boston called the Nickelodeon. Okay. Which was basically a five screen art house. And, I just took tickets and, cleaned up the theater and sold popcorn there. But I would go up to the projection booth. Those are platter projectors, which was different than the Brattle, which has the old school, 20 minute changeover projectors. But I would go up to the booth a lot and try to learn to be a projectionist when the projectionist would let me hang around. And the movie that I spent the most time with that was Blue Velvet, the David Lynch film. I heard and listened to that film probably 40 times during that period in my life, because I was interested in learning about theater projection. Yeah, so that was an interesting thing.
That's quite a film to learn on.
I still know all the dialogue to Blue Velvet because of that. But and working at the Brattle too, they certain kinds of films get played over and over again, like Hitchcock films or Casablanca, famously there. The Brattle is famous for its Bogart series that they run at certain times of the year. So, certain movies, I heard them so much that I learned the dialogue from them,
Very interesting.
And also another great thing about being in a projection booth is that you're by yourself, and as long as everything's set up, you have a lot of time on your hands to read. And I read a lot of you know, I read constantly in the booth, you know, which was great. You know, it was great for my literary education. I read complete, you know, works of certain authors during that period of my life. And I wonder if projectionists do that at all now because of smartphones. You know, they don't have to bring a book to the booth. They can just do stuff on their phone if they want.
Yeah, probably not. But I have to say, Scott, it feels like that experience has had some impact on your writing, because a lot of the time when you're writing about a film, I notice that you bring in references. It almost feels like you're watching things through the lens of other things. I love your essay about Kiarostami and The Purge, but I wonder if reading in front of a projection, while sitting in the projection booth, has sort of created you as a kind of dialectical critic, where you're always clashing together different texts, if I may.
Well,
if I may, I mean, overanalyze or just that, straight up analyze your work.
I mean, that's probably true. You know, I never really thought about it that way. One thing
you're
that
welcome.
Was interesting. Thank you. One thing that was
that's okay.
One thing that was interesting about the Brattle Theater projection booth, that it's actually behind the screen. It's a rear screen projection system in which the projectors don't face the screen but are facing each other and project into mirrors, which is then bounced onto the back of the screen. It was a system that was invented for cruise ships, for places where there's not a lot of space for projectors. And the Brattle had been a legitimate theater before it was a movie theater, so it didn't really have a booth. It has a balcony, but there's no booth behind the balcony. So I was actually sitting behind the screen when I was doing all that stuff, not in front of the screen, like in a traditional booth, which is projecting from above the seats. I was projecting kind of parallel to the seats behind the screen.
Okay. I don't know what that does metaphorically speaking, but that's an interesting
technological
footnote.
I'm actually trying to write something about this now, but to me, when you're a projectionist, you go into that booth and you spend, you know, 8 to 12 hours there. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're projecting Lawrence of Arabia or something all day, it's more than 12 hours. And being in a projection booth is like being in a submarine. You know, it's dark, it's not that big, and there's this giant glass window looking out into the sea, which is the movie theater, which is the movie itself, you know. And
so like Arrival. Sorry, like a scene from Arrival.
No, nothing like Arrival at all.
Okay. Not a sea of dark. Go on.
I'm not sure what you mean by that, though, actually.
The image of, I don't know, the darkness, and then she's standing in front of it. Never mind. Go on.
You mean Gravity or Arrival?
Arrival. Maybe I'm not. No.
I didn't like Arrival, so to me it wasn't that at all.
Go on, Scott. I interrupted you.
Anyway, it's a very immersive experience where it's almost like you're traveling underwater, you know, over time, you know, and it was really great. It's a great job. It's really a great job. I mean, it didn't pay that well, but that was the only problem with it. Other than that, it's really an excellent job. I highly recommend it. Although, there's not many places that do film projection anymore.
No, it sounds like it's a job as rare as the one that we're talking about right now, which is sort of being a paid film writer. Yes. Maybe even rarer, because I don't know how many theaters actually use that kind of projection technology anymore. Let's talk about your reviews. Now, the reviews in your book, many of them are these kinds of these like capsule reviews of very different films, but you find this kind of thematic link usually to connect them all together. What you've written, but for our listeners, some of them are like titled Depiction is Not Endorsement, and that links together Zero Dark 30, Amour and Django Unchained. Another one is called One Word, Authenticity, which includes Arrival, which we just talked about, Loving, and one of my least favorite movies of all time, glad you agree, Nocturnal Animals. I hate it so much. I just remember reading what you wrote about it.
You know, funny.
Made me angry again.
When I saw Nocturnal Animals, I saw it at BAM in Brooklyn.
Oh, okay.
And I saw it like the weekend it came out with someone, I went with somebody else. And it's probably the only movie I've ever seen where when it ended and everyone stood up, the person who was sitting next to me, who was a stranger, not the person I'd gone to the movie with, but the person on the other side. That person stood up and said to me, "Was that the worst film ever made?" Just totally out of the blue, you know?
Yeah, maybe that was Tom Ford's intention to bring people together over by making the worst movie in the history of cinema.
I think somehow the reputation of that film has grown, though. So,
in a positive direction? Well,
yes, in a positive direction.
I'm not sure why. Some hate mail from the New Books Network listeners.
Whenever you say something is terrible like that, it makes people want to see it. So,
let's not talk about it anymore then.
To me, that's an important point, because even when I write something negative, I want the person reading it to want to see the film themselves to see if they think I'm right.
No, I that makes sense. And that is sometimes the impact that certain reviews will have on me, negative reviews. I want to be part of it.
Right. I don't want to turn anyone off from seeing something, you know, or I don't want anyone just to accept what I say as true. You know, I want it to motivate them to do, you know, I don't know, to think about it, you know. And that movie in particular, although I despised it, I thought it was an amoral disaster made by someone who doesn't know what he's doing.
Right.
That was an insult to the actors in it, because it has very good actors in it.
It does. Amy. It really does.
You know, it's so repellent to that film. It's hard to understand what he was trying to do. And furthermore, the story involves a book that's being written. It's important in this discussion. The film's relationship to the publishing industry was completely fantastical.
Yes.
I remember when she is sent the galley of the book and it's like a velvet box. I mean, the whole thing was so out of touch with how anything works for writers. The movie's an insult to writers, really.
You know, I'm going to be generous and call myself a writer. And I won't say I was offended as a writer, but I was offended as a viewer, because much of the film is a book is a story within a story that is so painful to watch. And yet you're aware the whole time that it's a story. I wondered what I had done to deserve this horrible book. I didn't break up with Jake Gyllenhaal. I didn't know why this was happening to me. That was my take on Nocturnal Animals, but I haven't seen it since it came out, and I did see it in theaters.
It was also a deeply misogynistic film.
I would say more than writer. I was, as a woman, I was appalled and really uncomfortable the whole time, which sometimes is a very informative and important artistic journey, but not that one.
And furthermore, it was an insult to, you know, one area of cultural production that's very easy to mock is the art world.
Mm-hmm.
And films usually do it so poorly, and they try to more often than maybe they should. And that was a film where, you know, his attempt to mock the art world really fell flat in an embarrassing way. And, you know, presumably he has some real acquaintance with that world.
It seems like it. I mean, Tom Ford is fashion. I think you either wrote in that or a different review about how the fashion industry loves to see itself represented in film as sort of fascistic in some way.
I wrote that as
the ultimate compliment.
Was that in the Nocturnal Animals piece that I wrote that?
I can't remember. It could have been, I don't know if you reviewed The Devil Wears Prada, but it was in one of the shorter pieces. As I mentioned, these are capsule reviews, but they all kind of blend and bleed into each other. So I can't always remember where you say what you say.
I'd like to describe those a little differently maybe than you did, because they're not, I don't think of them as capsule reviews.
Okay. Give me a new term.
I'm not trying to do the things that people do in capsule reviews, because I leave so much out that would normally be included in a capsule review. And also those are usually longer than capsule reviews. So a capsule review to me is one paragraph that's like under 100 words.
Okay.
And some of those sections of those pieces, like there might be a review that's one sentence or two sentences, but there also might be that one that's, you know, 600, 700 words. And what those are, you know, those are my columns. Those are my columns for N+1 and The Baffler, in which I write about, you know, 12, you know, like 10 to 20 films that I've seen in like the last quarter, because the magazines I write for usually, you know, don't come out every month or every week. So, you know, I see a certain amount of films in the time that I have before my deadline, and then I try to write about all of them in those pieces. And I put them in a certain order. You know, I construct a kind of narrative order that's not obvious, I hope, but I'm not trying to link them thematically. They really are just a collection of whatever I happen to see in the period that I had between columns.
Well, you may not be trying to, but often I find that what you set up in one of the discussions sort of pays off somewhere else, or you find connections between them.
Yeah, I try to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, that is a question I had for you, which is like sort of how do you decide what to include and what not to include in these reviews, like in these sort of collections of different films? I assumed that it had something to do with when you saw resonances between them, but maybe that's something that came later.
Oh, yeah, that it comes, well, I mean, it comes when I'm writing
right.
the piece. Yeah, and I'm not like seeking resonances between them, mm-hmm. but resonances exist between them because they're a group of films that are all made around the same time usually. Although sometimes there's older films in there that I've seen that have been re-released because there's a lot of great movie theaters in New York City where, you know, older films are, you know, shown and re-released where they play for a week or 2 weeks. And I write about those too. But with new films, because they're all made, you know, relatively close to each other in time or very close to each other in time, they're going to have things in common because they're speaking about, you know, the time in which they're made. And, you know, even inadvertently, of course, they'll have things in common, you know. So oftentimes I do call those things out, I guess. But there's none of those pieces that were designed to do that, let's say.
That's not your master plan going into choosing what to see.
No. I don't have any plan in choosing what to see. I don't have any plan in choosing what to see. I just go to what I want to see, you know?
So N plus one and Baffler, they never tell you what they want you to see.
Oh, no. They never tell me what to see. They trust that I'll see things that are worth writing about.
And sometimes you write about movies you haven't seen.
Well, there's a couple of times that I wrote about films that I didn't see because I was turned away from the theater.
Let's talk about that, because I actually don't see that a lot in criticism.
Well, yeah.
Is people writing about movies they didn't watch, but you always manage to come up with some kind of connection. How do you, it's easy enough to decide what movies you want to write about when you've seen them, but what motivates you to write about a movie that you haven't seen, considering that if we're going to include it to writing about any movie that you've never seen, you can write about anything. So when and why do you decide to write about those turn away moments or those give up moments? Because I assume that there are other, that sometimes you don't write about the times you don't go to see the movie.
Anytime I go to a movie, I write about it. And then anytime I see a movie, like, let's say, you know, you've read the book, I know. So there's movies I reviewed that I saw because they were playing at a bar, like when I was sitting in a bar and the movie was on television.
I like that one. Yeah.
There's a piece where I reviewed a film that I wasn't actually watching, but someone sitting in front of me on an airplane was watching it. Like, I just couldn't hear it, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the time between columns, any film that I encounter, you know, if I see the whole thing, I will write about it. So in the case of the ones that I didn't see, in one case, I went to, it was like a Sunday morning matinee screening. So it was like in New York City. So it was like a 10:30 a.m. show. And I had a big cup of coffee and they wouldn't let me into the theater. And that movie was Life of Pi. You know, of course you can hide your coffee in your bag if you have one, you know, kind of, but I didn't have a bag. So I was just holding this coffee in my hand and I just bought it. And, you know, the kid, you know, lets you in after you buy your ticket, when you go up like the three sets of escalators or whatever, however many there are. And, you know, this was at the Regal Union Square. You know, he wouldn't let me in with the coffee. And he said, if you want to go into this movie, you have to throw this coffee away. And I said, well, you guys don't really sell coffee, you know, and that's whatever. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't let me in with the coffee. So I didn't get to see that movie. And, you know, and I'm not going to go back. I'm not going to circle back. You know what I mean? That was the one chance I had to see Life of Pi. And I didn't get to see it. So that's what I wrote, said. And the other instance was, I was going to see a film by Jean Cocteau that was playing in re-release. But at the same time, there was a publicity event for a movie called Hotel Artemis happening at the same theater. Yeah, and this publicity event had caused the showtimes of all the other movies to be pushed back like 40 minutes somehow. And, you know, there was no warning of that. So I went to that movie theater and met somebody there, actually. And the movie was, this film Hotel Artemis was holding up the showtimes. So there were a large number of people there waiting to see other movies who couldn't, and the crowd was getting angry. And there was a lot of security there, you know, this big Hollywood premiere for this movie that no one cares about and that nobody saw, had all sorts of security guys there and a lot of publicists. So I just wrote about that scene, you know, because that's what I experienced when I went to see that movie.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I've noticed that when you don't write about the movie, when you haven't seen the movie, what you offer instead in those rare instances is it feels like sort of an ethnographic or an anthropological study of movie culture. So I really enjoy those ones because I usually see something in them that reminds me not necessarily of the film, but like of what it's like to go to the movies right now.
Yeah.
When I go to a movie, I don't remember the going, I just remember the movie. But when something falls apart, what I remember is that process of trying to and failing to and leaving early or not getting in. Yes. And you write about those in a really funny way.
Yeah. Well, when things go wrong, you remember them more. But I remember I remember going to every movie that I've seen in the theater. Like going to see it is part of it, you know, it's part of it to me. And well, so, you know, every film that I've seen, which is, you know, a lot of movies, I pretty much remember, you know, where I saw it, who I saw it with, and so on.
Well, that must have made the last couple of years a little tricky.
Oh, the last couple of years have been a complete disaster in terms of film going, of course. Yes. I mean, it's been just terrible. I mean,
for everyone, but I meant specifically for you, that must be.
Yeah, well. Challenging. I mean, it was, I mean, the columns, I have another book coming out, I think by the end of this year, that will include all the columns that I wrote during the pandemic.
Oh, gosh.
And, you know, those, a lot of those columns, you know, I had to start watching films at home, which I didn't used to do. Mm-hmm. I only watched films at home if I was reviewing them, not as opposed to reviewing them, you know, like if I was watching it again, I would watch it at home on a DVD or Blu-ray or whatever, you know. On, I didn't, before the pandemic, I didn't have any streaming subscriptions, none.
Wow.
Yeah. So I mean, as a film critic in New York City, I just went to see everything in the theater. Mm-hmm. I don't live in New York City to sit at home watching television, you know, and the difference between going to a movie and doing that is just vast to me, you know. And you know, part of going to the movies too is, you know, you meet people afterward, or you go out afterward, the person you went to the movie with, or you have dinner beforehand, or maybe you go to another movie. There's just so much around the experience of seeing a movie, you know, in the movie theater, you know, actual cinema as opposed to watching television by yourself at home. I mean, they're just completely unrelated experiences to me. And, you know, I know, I worked in television for 8 years mm-hmm. for a consulting company that did brand strategy. So, you know, I had to watch every television show that our clients made, you know, that the clients for that company were ad supported cable, premium cable and broadcast television. And I just had to watch so much TV that the difference between the cinema and television became so, so stark to me. And for most people, I think in their minds, the two things are merging.
Of course, yes.
Because of the way that people watch things now, you know, which is of course what the studios want. I mean, the pandemic was such a great opportunity for them, which they really seized. And it was great for Netflix too, you know, until it wasn't. Mm-hmm. Because the quality of the stuff they make is so low, you know, and they were spending so much money on it. I mean, this was an unsustainable model. There's only so many people that they could get to subscribe to it, you know. But I don't enjoy television. I don't think it's good. I don't like the endlessness of it, you know, how much of it there is, and the episodic nature of television series that have no end point and just get worse and worse over time. And when I stopped working for that company, I was really happy that I stopped watching television completely. And I didn't watch it at all until I quit that job in 2016. And I didn't watch any television with the exception of, I watched Twin Peaks, The Return. And, you know, if there was some horrible tragedy in our nation, of which there are many, I would watch the news, you know. Right. I didn't watch any TV at all until the pandemic happened and I couldn't go to the movies anymore. And then I signed up for Criterion Collection and, you know, Mubi and, you know, Netflix and various other things that I could watch stuff. And at that time, you know, I go to press screening. I don't go to that many press screenings, but I do sometimes. Mm-hmm. I prefer to see movies after they come out with a regular audience. But, you know, the distributors started doing the press screenings through video portals that the critics had to kind of sign up for, or in some cases beg to be allowed to see. And that really was terrible. And I wrote a piece about that in Filmmaker Magazine.
Okay. I have to check that one out. I haven't seen that one.
Yeah. You know, when you're sitting at home watching a movie, you know, press screens at a certain time, like they're oftentimes in the morning, like at 10 in the morning, 10:30 in the morning, or they're at night and they're called all meet. There's like 2,000 people at them. So, but when you watch something at home, you know, you can watch it anytime, right? You have 2 days or something to watch it. You can watch it anytime. You can pause it. You know, you can, you know, and you know, life happens. When you're in a movie theater watching a movie, you know, you don't answer your phone, you don't stop the movie, you're not in control of how long that takes to play the movie. Whatever the running time is, that's how long it takes. When you're at home, it's the opposite of that. So during the pandemic, you know, a lot of bad things were happening. You know, a number of people I know died. So, I mean, they were mostly acquaintances, like people's parents and things. But terrible. Yeah. But, you know, if you're watching a screening at essentially a press screening, but you're watching it at home, you know, someone can call you up and say, oh, you know, my best friend just died. You remember that guy? You met him. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it was just so strange, you know, to be trying to do your job really and watch something and you're watching it at some weird time because it's the pandemic.
Yeah.
And people are calling with bad news and, you know, I mean, you could turn off your phone, but who does that? You know,
no, yeah, I understand.
Watch a movie at home. I mean, most movies you watch at home, you hope someone calls you, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, that was, the pandemic changed everything. It was a complete reversal of my life. And, you know, of course, that's trivial compared to what happened to some people. But, you know, to me, it was very grueling.
Yeah. You know? Well, I mean, it changed the nature of your job and the kind of work you were doing, it sounds like. And it, while in sort of on an institutional level, it changed, or an industry level, it sort of hastened the collapse of everything into content.
Yes.
Which you're telling, I mean, when you say you don't like TV, how do you, and I'm not saying this in a glib way, maybe I am. How do you even know what is TV? I mean, like an example I'm thinking of, it's not like a great example or a terrible example, but on Amazon, The Pursuit of Love, that one with Lily James, that was like 3 episodes of television, but in another world would have just been a long movie, or they could have cut a little bit and made it a movie. How do you know when you're watching television, when you're watching a movie? Is it that it is in a film, like in a theater? Is that how you make the distinction?
I mean, a movie or a film is a work, you know, with a beginning and an end point.
Okay.
That happens all at once. You know, in other words, there's no breaks.
Okay.
The breaks are not in the thing itself. You know, and it's true that a lot of episodic television, a lot of these dramatic miniseries in the post quality TV era were essentially movies that they stretched out into a series.
I mean, I've definitely watched some series that I thought, is this a movie? Like, why is this not a movie? Why did they make this a TV show?
I actually watched part of Underground Railroad, and that really had a feeling of being something that was a film that was stretched out over many episodes, and it didn't really work for me.
Is that because people don't want to make it, like the people who are making it have a lot they want to cram into it? Or is it that television is like the risk of, like, you know, I don't have a better word for it, like trendier than movies? Like people like to binge TV, so they want to make TV for these streaming sites. What do you think the rationale there is?
Just an industrial consideration. It's not trendy. Yeah. You know, it's they want people to subscribe to their streaming services and not go out. So if they think if they bring what they think are cinematic qualities to episodic television, people will stay home and watch this stuff and subscribe to their services. And, you know, the goal of all these kinds of services is for it to become like a utility, right? Mm-hmm. It's something you pay for every month, and you even forget that you're paying for it. You can have automated.
I do. That's true. Yeah.
So it's some weird combination of a utility like electric or gas, or like the gym. If you belong to a gym, you pay every month whether you go or not. You know, it's the same thing as that. If you're paying for Netflix by the month, it doesn't really matter to them whether you watch it or not.
Yeah.
You know,
I have some streamers where I think, oh my God, I forgot I have Peacock. Shoot, and then Peacock. I feel like I have to quickly watch something on it or cancel it.
Well, that's what's so great about Tubi, right? That it's free and it has so many amazing films on it. You just have to watch those ads like it was. It used to be late at night on UHF stations, you know, on broadcast television. But yeah, I think the industrial merger of television and the movies is a bad thing. And it's like a form of gentrification to me. Mm-hmm. And I have no trouble determining what's what. So all these conversations that happened mostly amongst television critics who were very upset when people said that Twin Peaks: The Return was not a television series. It was really an 18-hour long movie. I think that's exactly what it was in that case, because the same person wrote and directed the whole thing. And it was designed to be like, you know, a movie. So there were people that made television series in the past, like Fassbender, for instance. Mm-hmm. I thought I turned this off so it wouldn't happen. Hold on a second.
You want to take the call?
No, not at all.
Just kidding.
I just sent it to voicemail. So if you watch miniseries from the past, like a Fassbender one from the 70s, like 8 hours do not make a day, it does not seem like television. You know, Berlin Alexanderplatz doesn't really seem like television, because television doesn't really have auteurs in the sense that the cinema does, even though that concept is...
With the showrunner as their closest equivalent.
It's not the same thing as having a presiding artistic presence that is actually on the set in front of the actors, you know, next to the camera, directing something that maybe they wrote too. It's not the same thing at all. And also, oh, sorry, I don't know if you could hear that alert going off, but television looks so different from movies. It's just so clear, you know, to me. But what happened, I think, for a lot of the audience is that the what they consider to be the cinema, you know, shrunk over the years in this country, all around the world, really. It shrunk to this idea that the cinema equals a blockbuster movie. Mm-hmm. That's all it could be. And that really happened in the last 20 years, 22 years. In the 21st century, this has really happened. People's idea of what a movie is has shrunk to it being a blockbuster. Whether it's a Marvel movie or Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings or, you know, all these kinds of intellectual property movies, you know, these franchise movies have shrunk people's notions of what the cinema is. So there's a very clear distinction between a movie and television for a lot of people. And, you know, I don't really recognize that distinction in the same way, you know, because of my job that I used to have, where I had to watch so much TV, and because of being a film critic, where I have watched so many films, the more TV I watched, the more television-ish, so to speak, it became, you know. Mm-hmm. And also, I don't think that drama, you know, I don't think something like streaming drama, episodic streaming drama, to me, that's not natural to television. Television is really more things like talk shows and morning talk shows and sports and award shows and anything, the news, all the stuff.
So you think of like Raymond Williams and Flo, not the kind of dramatic episodic television you binge, but like the kind that sort of has that interrupted quality.
Yeah, the actual skeleton of television is all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And somehow, you know, all this, you know, so-called quality drama changed people's idea of what television was away from what it really is, which is, you know, the Today Show and the Tonight Show and the Grammys and football and news, breaking news, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. You know, the people, television critics really started concentrating on, you know, dramatic, you know, on television drama. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that the real TV that people will remember from that era, with a few exceptions like The Sopranos, I think most of what people are going to remember from that era is reality television. Mm-hmm. I think reality TV or so-called unscripted television will really be the marker of that historical era.
More of that transition into sort of that golden age, so to speak, or prestige television is that what you're talking about, that transition?
Yeah. I'm not talking about any kind of transition. I'm saying that
you're saying a certain period. What period? Can you just give me the year? Like, what are you looking at? 90s, 2000s? What are you saying?
No, I'm looking at the 21st century.
Oh, okay. Right now.
Sopranos.
Okay.
Yeah. And what I'm saying is that this period in television history will not be remembered for all the prestige drama.
Okay.
It's going to be remembered for all the reality television. It's going to be remembered for Here Comes Honey Boo Boo. And it's going to be remembered for The Apprentice making Donald Trump the president. And it's going to be remembered for Jersey Shore and all this stuff that was just seen as the worst things that our culture could produce. That is what's going to define the period. It's not going to be Mad Men. It's not going to be these retro shows like that. And it's not going to be, you know, you can name any of them, you know.
Yeah, I might have disagreed with you a few weeks ago, but after the week that we've had, I think you're right. Now I think you're right. Is this where you got the title for your book, which I'm going to plug again, The Earth Dies Streaming, which you can get from N+1 Books, and everyone listening should purchase or request for their library? Is that where you got this title, The Earth Dies Streaming?
The Earth this Dies Streaming.
Yeah.
Well, you can buy my book in bookstores too. You know, you can get it. It's great if you buy it directly from N+1, though.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, Amazon has it online too.
Sure. Anywhere books are sold.
Anywhere books are sold, pretty much.
Well, yeah, more or less.
You know, I got I mean, I was looking for a title for the book, and, you know, I was talking to a film director that I know, and in our conversation, that phrase just popped into my mind. Because of, there's a British science fiction movie from their early or mid 60s called The Earth Dies Screaming. Mm-hmm. And The Earth Dies Screaming was also the name of a pop song by UB40 and also one by Tom Waits. And, you know, The Earth Dies Screaming just came to me, you know, like things come to you sometimes, you know, and. Right. And it turned out to be a prescient title. And I think it sold a lot of copies during the pandemic because of that, because of the title, you know?
Absolutely. No, that makes sense.
You know, I mean, that seemed to be what was going on, you know, in 2020. Mm-hmm. And, the book came out at the end of 2018. And I had just done a kind of a book tour for it. And I'd just done what was the last date of that. I had just gotten back from Seattle the last week of February. In Seattle, if you recall, was really where the pandemic started in the US. And the week that I was in Seattle was it was about 10 days, I guess. It was kind of crazy there. And then I came home and 2 weeks later, everything was closed. And a lot of people started pointing out to me that the title of the book seemed to really be summing things up in some ways.
I think it definitely does. How did you pick what to include and what to leave out from all your published work? And are there any pieces in here that were not published elsewhere?
There are no pieces in the book that were not published elsewhere, except for the very long introduction, which is called Remember Me on This Computer,
right?
Which was published after the book came out on N+1's website. Mm-hmm. And it's still there. But everything else in the book, you know, there's 42 pieces in the book. They were all published previously between 2002 and 2018. And, during that whole period, I was working, I had a full-time job throughout most of that period, as a brand analyst in the television industry. But, so I wrote, there were some years, unfortunately, where I only wrote like maybe two pieces that I thought were worth including in the book, because I was just working in my full-time job so much. But, you know, the book includes maybe 50% of everything I wrote in that period, maybe 40%. So, you know, my editor and I just picked the ones that were the best one we thought were the best ones, you know.
Great way to pick, yeah.
Yeah, and the book is in, you know, reverse chronological order. So it starts with the most recent piece and ends with one from, 2002. There's more stuff from the last 10 years than there is from the previous 6 years before that, you know.
Right. You can tell that when reading.
Mm-hmm. It's really only writing that I did since I moved to New York City in 2000. Mm-hmm. All the writing that I did in Boston in the 90s and in 2001, I didn't really include any of that in the book.
One thing I want to draw out from the book is that you have a few pieces about film critics. So you write, most of the essays in here are about films that you've seen, but some of them are about film critics. You have essays on Jonathan Rosenbaum, David Thompson, Mandy Farber, very clear-eyed, but mostly admiring. Are they some of the writers that have shaped your own style and sort of your emphasis, not sort of an emphasis, like your entire emphasis on cinema over television and other kinds of media, audiovisual media? What writers have shaped you?
Well, Manny Farber is one, and the piece on Manny Farber in the book was written right after he died. It was basically a memoriam, that piece. Mm-hmm. I just love his work so much. For people who don't know who he was, who are listening to this, he was an American film critic who wrote from the 1940s through the 1970s. And published a book called Negative Space, which collected his essays, which I read when I was in high school, and it had a profound impact on me. I just found it randomly in a used bookstore. I didn't even know what it was. I'd read one Farber essay in a collection that Daniel Talbot had done, which was a piece called Underground Movies, which was not about avant-garde films, but about Hollywood B-movies. And so I recognized his name when I bought the book, but that book really had an impact on me. And Jonathan Rosenbaum was a guy that I read, you know, in the 80s and 90s, you know, all the time, as much as possible, you know, his column in the Chicago Reader and the books that he wrote. David Thompson, and the piece on Rosenbaum was occasioned by a book that he published called Goodbye Cinema, Hello Cinephilia, which is an interesting collection of his work. And, you know, he's from a generation that's obsessed with the death of cinema, and hence, the, you know, that title, you know. Mm-hmm. And the David Thompson piece was also because he had a book out, which was a memoir. It was a memoir of his adolescence and his terrible relationship with his father, who seems like he was a horrible person. And I love David Thompson's work from the 70s, but I'm not a big fan of anything he's written since then. Mm-hmm. And I also feel that I have a lot in common with him as a person, which troubles me. And so that was a piece about that kind of stuff. But I like writing pieces on critics. I wrote the introduction to a collection of works. Well, it's actually a book that collects Serge Denis's writing from Cahiers du Cinéma from the early 60s through the early 80s. That's coming out in September. It's the first in a series of translated books by Serge Denis that Semiotext is publishing. And I wrote the introduction to that. So I enjoy writing pieces about other critics. And in the next book I do, that will be in it, and other stuff like that.
All right. So just to remind listeners, The Earth Dies streaming is available right now where books are sold. This September, they should look out for the Serge Denis's translated works, which you are introducing, that comes out in September. And yeah, they should keep an eye open for your upcoming collection of criticism, which should be in the coming year.
Yes. And the Serge Denis collection is called The Cinema House and the World.
The Cinema House and the World. Okay. I think you can already pre-order that. Or, you know, express an interest to your neighborhood bookseller. Go in and talk that you want them to order it. Is that how it works?
I think the Serge Denis book is going to sell out fast.
Okay.
Yeah. So if anybody wants to own that book, if anyone wants to read that book and own it, they should pre-order it.
Okay. Good note. Thank you. Well, as we wrap up here, you know, I know that NPR likes to do NPR Arts, Pop Culture Happy Hour. I don't know exactly everywhere they do this, but they do a Things Making Me Happy this week. I don't want to get sued, so we won't use that. But if you'd like to end us on something that you've watched, read, or consumed that didn't make you unhappy this week or leave you terribly cold, I think that listeners would appreciate it.
Well, the last movie that I saw in a theater that I really loved was Crimes of the Future, the new David Cronenberg film. And it's great that he hasn't had a film out in about 10 years. So it was really great to see that. And I saw it at a Cineplex in New Jersey, and I really enjoyed it. And it's really a creepy, excellent movie with Viggo Mortensen and Lea Seydoux and Kristen Stewart. And it's, you know, it takes Cronenberg's kind of body horror, which, you know, is a genre that he kind of created. You know, I'm not sure if it's calling this a genre is really right, but it's a term that people like to use now.
Genre? Sure.
No, body horror.
Body horror. And, people do like to say genre, sure. Body horror, absolutely.
Yeah. It takes it to a level, a kind of elegiac level that I thought was great. And it's a very compact film too. And I really enjoyed seeing that. And other than that, I'm not sure what else to recommend.
I think that's a solid recommendation. Thank you. Anything else? I mean, you have a lot of work coming out. Is there anything else you'd like to plug?
No, nothing in particular right now. No.
Just keep reading your work at Baffler.
Yeah. And you know, and I'll have a new collection out pretty soon, I hope.
Well, great. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for joining me today. And thank you to everyone for listening. This is New Books in Film, and you've been listening to A.S. Hamrath.